This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yahis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
At this stage, everybody in Angola is waiting for the results of Wednesday's election. The National Electoral Commission hasn't released full results yet. We're still waiting. We've been waiting for some hours here in the official Electoral Commission building in Luanda.
That was VOA correspondent Anita Powell reporting from Luanda, Angola, where vote counting is taking place. Details next.
Also, North Africa as well as the Middle East had the most terror attack victims last year, with more than 19,000 killed by extremists. And a suicide bomber kills two people and injures 11 in Nigeria's northeastern city of Maiduguri.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Preliminary results from Wednesday's presidential election in Angola show the ruling MPLA party is winning so far by substantial margins in areas around the country, with one exception. VOA correspondent Anita Powell is in Luanda covering the election. She provides us with an update on the vote counting and a surprise result.
So the National Electoral Commission just announced preliminary provisional results, which means these are not the final results. But what they did show was something quite extraordinary. The ruling MPLA party won in every single one of the 18 provinces that they have announced results for. That's all of the provinces. And they won by fairly large margins.
I understand that, though, there was something very unique that occurred in Luanda.
The exception to this pretty uniform route was the crown jewel, which was the province of Luanda, which has about 6 million people and 2 million voters. Here in Luanda, that's the capital, the MPLA, the ruling party, won just over 50%. And 34% went to UNITA, which is the largest opposition party, and just under 14% went to CASASE, which is another opposition coalition that is very popular in the capital. So this does present a challenge to the ruling party in that here in the capital, where a lot of citizens see both the largesse, both the wealth of the ruling party, the wealth of the officials who have ruled Rwanda for so long and are living in poverty, they're going to expect results. And they are going to be much more critical of their government, which could lead to friction in the future. The other thing I wanted to say is that, as you know, the opposition UNITA party said that they were going to do their own vote count, as did the opposition CASASE party. I just spoke to a spokesman for the UNITA party, and he disputed the election results. He says UNITA is doing their own count. He also said that the parties are going to demonstrate, didn't give any specifics on that, but he said, however, that he encourages everybody to stay calm, to maintain peace with these results, although the opposition has made very clear that they are not happy and they do not believe this to be a legitimate reflection of voters' wealth.
If they do their own counts, what will that mean?
By definition, the only official vote count is the one that I just gave you, which is that from the National Electoral Commission. That's the only recognized count, and that's the mechanism by which this election has been conducted. The only count that I guess one could officially take to the bank is the National Electoral Commission count. The opposition counts are just in tandem with that. These are their own counts based on their own polling data. They say that they've seen different results and they've done better than these official results indicate, which casts many doubts over the electoral process.
With these latest results just being released, what are people saying about it so far?
It's taken them about 5 hours in the National Election Commission to tell us this. So most of the capital journalists have been cooped up in one place. What I can tell you is that here in Luanda, especially in the poorer neighborhoods that were very opposition-oriented, people are expectant and they're a bit nervous. And this news of pretty widespread ruling party victory in the country, this is probably going to be met with disapproval. To zoom out to the entire country, countrywide, the ruling MPLA won about 64%. And together, UNITA and CASASE, which are the two largest opposition parties, 24% and 8.5% respectively, which means that it's still about a two-thirds, one-third situation. That gives the ruling party still a lot of power.
That was VOA correspondent Anita Powell in Luanda.
It's been 2 years since the South Sudan peace deal was signed, but the country has had very little peace since then. Today, the United Nations is getting an update on the ongoing conflict and humanitarian crisis there. Nicholas Haysom, the UN Special Envoy for Sudan and South Sudan, did not have very encouraging news.
Since my last briefing 2 months ago, the five internal and regional initiatives to address the crisis in one form or another indicate continuing concern over the trajectory and depth of the conflict, without any of them so far presenting a definite breakthrough in the political impasse. However, I remain hopeful that some or a combination of them may have the potential to positively impact the situation.
Haysom says there is sporadic fighting and widespread insecurity across the country.
For our part, we've made clear to all external and internal stakeholders our view that the prevailing insecurity, internal and external population displacement, the lack of appropriate institutions or a reasonably level political playing field in an increasingly divided ethnic environment militate against organizing credible elections within the year. Indeed, it may well contribute to deepening and extending the conflict.
There are a number of efforts underway to end the conflict. Haysom says the effort by IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, is showing some promise.
The decision of the IGAD Heads of State Summit of 12th of June to convene a high-level revitalization forum in respect of the 2015 IGAD-sponsored peace agreement has begun to gain some momentum. It aims to include government and opposition groups in a dialogue to consider how to implement the peace agreement, and IGAD has appointed Special Envoy Ambassador Ishmael Weiss to follow through on its decisions. Recognizing the importance of securing President Kiir's buy-in, the IGAD Council of Foreign Ministers met in Juba on the 24th and 25th of July. Following that, IGAD, with help from JMEC, UNMIS and my office, carried out a mapping exercise on the relevant opposition actors to be included in the revitalization forum. In mid-August, I attended an IGAD-hosted meeting of independent South Sudanese experts in Ethiopia. The discussions were frank and generated a number of recommendations for IGAD, including on which opposition parties to engage and how the peace agreement could be adjusted to reflect the new realities in South Sudan.
However, the UN Special Envoy for Sudan and South Sudan says IGAD must guard against appearing partisan in the peace process. Nicholas Haysom spoke today at the United Nations in New York.
The Middle East and North Africa had the most terror attack victims last year, with more than 19,000 people being killed by extremists. That's more than half of the global figure of over 34,000. Iraq suffered 11 of the deadliest terror attacks of 2016, while in sub-Saharan Africa, Nigeria and Somalia had the most attacks due to Boko Haram and al-Shabaab militants. According to AFP, the Global Terrorism Database at the University of Maryland says Western Europe accounted for less than 1% of the world's victims, with 238. There were more than 19,000 terror attacks globally last year. Islamic State is called the deadliest extremist group, with 1,400 atrocities that killed 11,700 people. The findings show there has been a marked increase in the frequency and lethality of these attacks.
In northeastern Nigeria, a suicide bomber killed two people and injured 11 others yesterday in an attack in Maiduguri. The capital of Borno State is a frequent target of Boko Haram. AFP reports a suicide bomber blew himself up at Muna Garage on the edge of the city. A police officer was one of the victims, while seven members of the special anti-robbery squad were injured. The bomb went off near an armored vehicle that was on patrol.
Children are among the hardest hit psychologically by the August 14th mudslide in Freetown, Sierra Leone. The official death toll stands at more than 500, but hundreds more are still missing after heavy rains washed away part of Mount Sugarloaf. Aid officials say hundreds of children have lost one or both parents, but some 4,000 children have been affected overall by the tragedy. Officials are trying to contact the extended families of orphaned children. The tragedy comes on the heels of the West Africa Ebola outbreak, which decimated many families in Sierra Leone just a few years ago. Many children are receiving psychological support before they return to school next month.
Those who are fortunate enough to survive infection with the Ebola virus could still face multiple health problems. New research says 80% of Ebola survivors suffer disabilities 1 year after being discharged from the hospital. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
The 2014 to 2016 West Africa Ebola outbreak killed about 11,000 people. But tens of thousands who were infected survived. However, that does not mean their lives returned to normal. In fact, for many, it was just the opposite. Dr. Janet Scott is a clinical lecturer of pharmacology and infectious disease at the University of Liverpool and one of the senior authors of the study. Researchers at the university and the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine are studying what's called post-Ebola syndrome.
Once a patient is discharged from the treatment center, they have survived, but that's not quite the end of it. We found that quite a lot of our patients were coming back with various sorts of aches and pains and problems.
These included headaches that lasted for months and vision problems. Researchers surveyed the patients a few weeks after they were discharged and began recording Ebola's after effects. But why are survivors experiencing such disabilities?
That's a really good question, and I'm not sure we've quite got to the bottom of it yet. The idea that you go through something as horrific as Ebola and you just walk away from that unscathed was always a bit of a vain hope. So it could be the inflammatory response, it could be damage to the muscle, it could be the persistence of virus in some cases. It could be all of those things.
Scott says problems found in Ebola survivors' eyes may provide a clue as to what's happening elsewhere in the body.
They show some quite distinct scarring patterns. So there's definitely scar tissue there. We can see it in the eyes. We can't see it in the rest of the body, but I'm sure it's in the rest of the body because the patients are coming in with this huge range of problems. So there was definitely something going on.
These disabilities were reported in past Ebola outbreaks as well, but they were very small compared to the West Africa outbreak, and there were few survivors. So researchers were not able to do any major long-term study on the after effects.
There are 5,000 survivors, there thereabouts, in Sierra Leone alone and more in Guinea and Liberia. So it's an opportunity from a research point of view to find out the full spectrum of sequelae. Sequelae are the things that happen after an acute illness.
Military Hospital 34 in Freetown, Sierra Leone also took part in the study, helping to recruit 27 Ebola virus disease survivors and 54 close contacts who were not infected. About 80% of survivors reported disabilities, compared to just 11% of close contacts.
The problems we're seeing in the Ebola survivors, this is not due just to the tough life in Sierra Leone. This is more than likely down to their experience in Ebola.
Dr. Scott hopes the findings can be used to provide better care in the event of another Ebola outbreak, no matter where it is. She says in the West Africa outbreak, the first goal was to contain the epidemic, followed by reducing the death rate.
If I was treating an Ebola patient again, it has to be more than just surviving. We have to try to make people survive well. Surviving with half your body paralyzed or with your vision impaired and being unable to care for your family or earn a living isn't really enough. So what I would like to do is to focus on that aspect to make people survive better and to survive well.
The research in which Dr. Scott took part was led by Dr. Sushieta Jagadesh of the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. She says that a year following acute disease, survivors of West Africa Ebola virus disease continue to have a higher chance of disability in mobility, cognition, and vision. She adds that issues such as anxiety and depression persist in survivors and must not be neglected. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suheep. 20 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Preliminary results from yesterday's presidential election in Angola show the ruling MPLA party winning. North Africa, as well as the Middle East, had the most terror attack victims last year, with more than 19,000 killed by extremists. And a suicide bomber kills two people and injures 11 in Nigeria's northeastern city of Maiduguri. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
A South African model who was allegedly beaten with an electrical cord by Zimbabwe's First Lady is trying to make sure Grace Mugabe stands trial. AFP reports the lawyer for 20-year-old Gabriella Engels has gone to court, seeking to overturn the government's decision to grant Mugabe diplomatic immunity. Mugabe allegedly attacked Engels at a Johannesburg hotel for partying with her two sons. South Africa's Foreign Affairs Ministry has granted her diplomatic immunity, allowing her to leave the country. Engels has already filed an assault charge against Grace Mugabe. Now she has the support of the civil rights group AfriForum in seeking an injunction against the ministry's decision. A court hearing on the case opens September 19th.
The world's largest non-government hospital ship is docked in Cameroon's commercial capital, Douala. Medical staff and volunteers from around the world plan to provide nearly 3,000 free surgeries on the ship over the next 10 months. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Douala, where local healthcare centers are scarce.
15 patients board the Africa Mercy. Bernadette Abugio traveled 600 kilometers from eastern Cameroon. Her two children suffer from club foot. She says she brought them here because she has been told that they will get free operations. She says she is very grateful because she does not have the money to take the children to the hospital. Clubfoot is just one of many ailments for which little surgical treatment is available in Cameroon. The Ministry of Health reports that the country has just 4,200 medical doctors for a population of 23 million, and only about half are practicing. This ambulance rushed to the Yaounde General Hospital last month to find hundreds of patients suffering kidney defects blocking the hospital entrance. They said they had not received treatment for 2 months. Their leader, Alois Ovidi, said almost all equipment was broken. He says the government has not been fulfilling its promises, even though it is aware 32 people living with kidney defects had died in less than 2 months. He says others can no longer walk because only 8 of the 17 dialysis machines at the General Hospital in Yaounde are functioning. He says instead of the 4 hours of treatment, patients are receiving just 3. Outside the two main cities of Yaounde and Douala, quality medical care is even harder to find. The Ministry of Health says the majority of the population relies instead of traditional healers. Cameroon's health minister, André Mamafuda, told VOA only 7% of the national budget is allocated for health care.
Les prévisions montrent qu'un pays qui accorde 15% de son budget.
He says raising that allocation to 15% would enable the country to develop the health sector, including infrastructure and surgical equipment. He says many more people should have access to health care But unfortunately, the country has many other development priorities and only limited resources. Back in the waters of Douala, flags fly on the Africa Mercy, the gigantic white vessel housing Mercy Ship's mobile hospital. The flags represent some of the 40 nationalities of the medical staff and volunteers on board. Wari Blackburn is the managing director of Mercy Ships. The US-based charity has operated hospital ships in developing nations since 1978.
About 3,000 people from Cameroon we're hoping to help surgically. In addition, we are also planning to help with the training of nurses and doctors and other healthcare professionals.
She said they have selected the patients on the basis of need, focusing on surgeries that cannot be performed in local hospitals for lack of equipment and qualified staff. Such surgeries include tumor removal and repair of hernias, obstetric fistulas, cleft palates, and cataracts. The government of Cameroon is providing transportation, lodging, and food for patients and their families while they receive care. Mercy Ships hopes to train 1,000 local healthcare workers to do follow-up care and help other patients before the ship raises anchor in June 2018. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Douala, Cameroon.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.